matters
vitally affecting the community.
The Pacifica Mission Statement.
Hi, this is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage.
Given what happened this weekend, I decided to shift today with to talk about the U.S. imperialist attack on Venezuela. Trump comes along over the weekend and with his actions on Saturday made it clear that while AI may be a looming threat to democracy, our own president in the U.S., number 47 right now, is the true current and real threat to democracy in the U.S. And he is bent on enforcing a very old colonial order, despite what the American people may want. And I say the American people because I think even MAGA folks have said that they want to see an America First policy that does not include overseas wars and entanglements. I saw Marjorie Taylor Greene on Meet the Press talking about that very same thing, which is, you know, mind-blowing in itself. We don't want to see us get involved in overseas wars and all these entanglements. But, of course, as many people realize, we don't really quite have a functioning democracy right now. We, I believe, have been in a constitutional crisis since number 47 was first elected. And now he's further pushed the U.S. into breaking international law by violating Venezuela's national sovereignty and seriously endangering the global rules-based order. I mean, if you think Israel's Netanyahu and Putin's Russia is shredding international norms and customs, well, hell, the U.S. is also riding that train, and the consequences of such actions are making all of us in the U.S. and the Southern Hemisphere, all around the world, incredibly unsafe. About the military buildup that was happening in Puerto Rico prior to this weekend's actions. I mean, people in Puerto Rico, military bases that had long been closed, that were supposed to be cleaned up, have been reopened and being used. So Puerto Ricans knew what was happening and what was going to happen. So what do you think we should be doing? What are you doing? Have you been to a protest? Are you planning to attend a protest? I want to turn our attention to some commentary about what happened in Venezuela from a historian and an academic and a woman. Her name is Dr. Heather Cox Richardson. Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College. She's an expert in 19th century America, specializing in politics and economics. She has a nightly newsletter, Letters from an American, which has over 5 million readers. Her award-winning book spans subjects from the Civil War and Reconstruction to the Gilded Age, the American West, and the history of the Republican Party through to the Trump administration. She is the author most recently of the best-selling book Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America, which Jane Mayer from The New Yorker called a vibrant and essential history of America's unending, enraging, and utterly compelling struggle since its founding to live up to its own best ideals. I mean, when we think about our founding documents and the promises laid out there and where we are today, I shudder. So Dr. Richardson's articles and reviews have been published in The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Guardian. So this is a talk I'm about to play. She posted with the title, How the U.S. Taking Out Maduro Matters to the World. So we're going to listen to that talk. So let's take a listen. Here is Dr. Heather Cox Richardson, professor at Boston College. Let's take a listen to what she has to say in a talk titled, What the World Should Know About Maduro Being Taken Out.
Because I wanted to get to this part, and this is actually why I'm here this morning. This is a really, really, really big deal. that the United States has struck Venezuela. And the reason that it is such a big deal, aside from everything else I've just said, is because the United States, with this action, has signed on to the project of destroying the rules-based international order that the Allies, after World War II, worked with other countries to put together to prevent future wars. What that means is this. Remember in the early 20th century, we had World War I, and then before that had was even in the rearview mirror practically, we had World War II. And those wars are just hideous, hideous wars. I mean, they're world wars, right? And you know all the stories about both of them. At the end of World War II, the Allies, of which the United States was a major partner, recognized two things. They recognized that the world had to have a better way to solve differences between countries. And they recognized, especially Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower is going to become the United States president in 1953, was the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. And he recognized the importance of this. And that is, at the end of World War II, the world has nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons are game changers, you know, because what they do is they say if countries get mad enough at each other and you get a wackadoodle in charge, and he doesn't use the word wackadoodle, but it works. He's talking not only about political extremists, but also religious extremists and other extremists who can commandeer a population. This is a little bit of a rabbit hole I'm going to give you, but this is a real issue after World War II. People are trying to figure out why populations will follow a wackadoodle like Mussolini or Hitler or whatever. And this is this is where a lot of my work centers, is how do you get a population to say, oh yeah, I'm okay with this. And Eisenhower cares deeply about this. It was actually studying Eisenhower that got me interested in it, because Eisenhower recognized that it was such a huge deal for the world going forward. He was profoundly moved by having seen the Order of Prison Camp and what humans would do to each other. And he recognized that if humans would do that to each other in a world that had nuclear weapons, they could literally end the world. So at the end of World War II, the Allies and their partners got together and said, we have to come up with a better way. And what they did is they came up with the idea that across the globe, there would be rules, that rather than just having rules within a state, within a country, that there would be rules for the world. And those rules, some of them were financial, some of them were, you know, we've got the International Declaration of Human Rights. There are all these different ways that the countries in the world were supposed to work together. And crucial, crucial, crucial to that was the United Nations. The United Nations eventually becomes headquartered in New York, and the United States is like the anchor of the United Nations. And the United Nations matter for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons the United Nations matter is because it says other countries or countries cannot invade each other. You cannot just say, I want your oil and go into that country, which is the way we got into the messes of World Wars I and II, that you must respect each other's sovereignty. And then there are all these ways that we can work out disputes and so on. Now, there are people, and I am one of them, who have always felt that there was a weakness written into that charter. But I'm not sure that's a rabbit hole you want me to get into. The point here is that there were rules, and big countries were not supposed to invade little countries, bigger countries. So if you think, for example, about the first Gulf War, what the United States did under Republican President George H.W. Bush is they said to Iraq, no, you can't take Kuwait. And that, I don't know about you, when I was much younger then, and I was like, oh, it's all about the oil. But in fact, there was the principle that Iraq could not simply say, hey, I'm taking Kuwait. We pushed, if you remember, the United States troops pushed Iraq back over the border and stopped. So, you know, you do you, but we are going to make sure that you can't just take over a smaller country. All right, that's the rules-based international order. Now, Russia doesn't like that. Under Putin, Russia does not want the international, the rules-based international order, because it wants Ukraine and it also wants other countries, but pretty openly wants Ukraine. And this has been a struggle that's been going on. Remember that the United States, Russia, and the UK promised that we would respect Ukraine's sovereignty if Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. It did give up its nuclear weapons, and in goes Russia in 2014. And the United States stood against that, but somewhat half-heartedly. And this is the struggle that's been going on since then, since 2014, for the control of especially those eastern parts of Ukraine. Putin needs those. He wants those and he needs those. There's all kinds of problems in the Russian economy, which is actually quite an interesting rabbit hole that I won't take you down right now. But he wants and needs those industrial areas of Ukraine in order to prop up his own rule in Russia. And that's in real trouble right now. Meanwhile, he also recognizes that Trump's position, including his mental position, is dramatically weakening. So if he's going to get that, he's got to get that now. So one of the things that Putin has articulated repeatedly is the desire to get rid of the rules-based international order, which he says is threatening him, even though it's simply saying, no, you can't take over Ukraine. And he wants to replace it with something based in the idea of spheres of influence. That is, you'll get one really big dog in an area, and all the other countries are going to have to do what it says. And that's his plan for going forward. And he obviously wants control of Ukraine, and he wants to continue to influence and gain control over Europe. And this is one of the things that Europe is madly trying to prevent. You're seeing the militarization of the borders with Russia and the repeated defense capabilities increasing in Europe. And they're saying we're very concerned about Russia deciding it's going to do more than it is already doing in Europe, where it's poisoning people and attacking undersea cables and hitting infrastructure and so on. There was an attack on Poland less than a month ago, I think, in which a train track was blown up. Russia wants to get rid of that rules-based international order because it wants more. It wants to more influence in Ukraine, and it also wants influence in Russia. But there's more than that. Russia can't do that on its own. Russia is not strong. Russia's economy, as I say, is in really bad shape. And Putin's got a real problem. He's lost more than 1 million men in his war on Ukraine, which he expected would take a few days, right? How can he possibly do that? He can't. But the biggest dog in the world is the United States of America. So if he could get the United States of America to sign on to that, the game has changed. And this is one of the reasons that a number of people, including me, have called attention to the United States's national security strategy document that came out about a month ago, in which the United States no longer said Russia was a problem, but began to attack Europe, our ally in this international rules-based order. With the U.S. attack on Venezuela against the tenets of the UN Charter, the United States is putting its stamp of at least condoning a big power attacking a smaller power. And you know that this is what's going on because instantly Taiwan, which is very concerned about an invasion from China, popped onto social media and said, hey, we're not buying this. You know, we're still believe in our sovereignty. And Europe instantly said, we still believe in the rules-based international order because they want to hold off Russia. So what the United States just did is it said, we're tossing overboard the rules that have kept the world from another world war since the 1940s and instead believing that we want to have our own sphere of influence. And you can see this with Trump talking about taking Greenland, which, by the way, in April, feels like a million years ago, Putin gave a speech saying, hey, take this seriously because the U.S. should have Greenland. Well, what's in Greenland is, of course, access to more resources, but also if the U.S. had more power over Canada, Greenland, the United States, and now South America, it becomes the hegemon of the Western Hemisphere here. It is a much weaker position for the United States than it has had since the 1940s, because rather than being part of the entire globe, we simply become the power that's going to grab all the resources in other countries. But it's one that looks very attractive to somebody like Donald Trump because of the degree to which he and his cronies can do what Putin has done, which is strip the lands for parts and put the money in their own pockets. And, you know, already we are seeing people in Trump's circle reaching for the oil in Venezuela, and there's just going to be extraordinary corruption around this. Trump has done this without the approval of Congress. And that's the final piece here that you need to pay attention to. He is claiming the right to invade another country without provocation. I mean, this idea that these are narco-terrorists that are hurting the United States is a fantasy. Without provocation and without consultation with Congress. And this was really deliberate. The first attack on the boats was on September 2nd. That's the double tap strike that has, you know, gotten such attention. But it was on September 2nd, and within 2 days, under the War Powers Act of 1973, the president has to inform Congress that he has done so. And Trump did that. And he said, I'm informing you because of the War Powers Act. But under the War Powers Act, the president has only 60 days to act without getting approval of Congress to continue those strikes. And Trump just blew through that. He never got that approval. And now he has just continued with that, going into Venezuela without Congress. Congress under the Constitution is the only body that can declare war. And again, under the War Powers Act, he ought to have consulted with them. It appears, as I say, very early days here, that he informed Republicans in the, at least on the Gang of Eight, that he was going in, but not the Democrats, which says he is declaring himself the leader of a one-party dictatorial state. And that's the other piece here. When you think about this, again, Maduro is nobody's buddy. He's just not. But there are the way that Trump has done this, and Trump's advisors, by the way, I'm not sure how much of this is Trump and how much he just likes the bangs, which is what he was talking about on the Fox News channel. The way he has done this not only destroys the rules-based international order, it also destroys another guardrail of the Constitution. So when I say this is a really, 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 really big deal, this is a cornered president who is in serious trouble with the American people and with legal issues over, I mean, he seems to think the problem with the Epstein files, at least so he says, is that people will be embarrassed. They're not hiding those files to stop people from being embarrassed. They're hiding those files because there's something huge in them. And by the way, I was an Epstein files skeptic big time. But the more they're doing this and the more we're seeing, the more you know there's just got to be something there. Or they would have released them all. And then we've got Jack Smith out there right before January 6th, which is coming up in 3 days. And has been a real issue of concern for a lot of us, is that on the fifth year anniversary of January 6th, he would try something. Well, here we have an attack on the rules-based international order. Here we have an attack on the U.S. Constitution. And if we get rid of those two things because of the direction and the ideology of people like Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, the next step in the United States is to move more and more into an authoritarian regime like that. And if that authoritarian regime like that, gets its full hold here in the United States. You can look at Russia now, where there's a very few people who are extraordinarily rich, but whose lives are very much in danger. A lot of them seem to have a lot of problems with windows and poison. And you can assume that these trends that we're seeing in the United States already are going to be coming here. So when you see people saying, well, Maduro is a bad guy, this is a great way to get rid of him, this is the way the United States should operate, be very clear that Maduro is absolutely a bad guy. But if you break all the rules to get him the way Trump has done, what's being destroyed is not simply Maduro's regime. And by the way, I should have said this, heads of state enjoy immunity. There's no way that we should have the right to try him, especially since we did try and convict by a jury of the former president of Honduras, who was doing the drug trafficking, and Trump just pardoned him. So as people are saying at this point, Maduro's people are probably looking at how much money it will take to free Maduro if he puts it in the pocket of Trump, which is, of course, exactly what Putin does, grabs people and then uses them essentially as hostages. So this late or early morning strike against Venezuela is not simply, let's get rid of a bad guy. It is, and by the way, there was an election in Venezuela in 2024. There is an elected leader that was not Maduro. My guess is the Trump administration is not going to be putting that person in power, but we'll see. But when you look at this moment, this is a huge crisis for the United States of America, not just for Venezuela. And it is a huge crisis for the world because of the breakdown of that rules-based international order that has kept us from a war since World War II. Not, you know, we've had local wars, but we've not had a world war, a war in Europe, for example. And it is a direct attack on the U.S., another direct attack on the U.S. Constitution. So don't be fuzzy about what happened here. And this would be a great moment to speak up to your Congress people, especially your Republican Congress people. The Democrats have already come out and said, excuse me, what are you doing here? But they are not in the majority. And a lot of the Republicans started out, even the far right ones started out by saying, hey, wait a second here. This doesn't look legal. And they're already starting to come around because generally wars make a president more popular and they don't want to buck Trump and say, we're going to back Maduro on this. Because again, Maduro's a bad guy. Light up these freaking phones, because I think if you've listened to me before, you've heard me say that we're facing a crisis. Because Trump has gotten more and more and more and more cornered. And as I've been saying and wincing, the next 3 months, which I said 3 days ago, are going to be hideous as he and his people try to maintain control. Because it's coming down to the line here. Either they are going to grab control and turn the United States into a dictatorship, or the American people are going to take our system back and we're going to make it based in the law again and not in personalities. And we're going to start to enforce the laws against corruption, and we're going to enforce the Constitution. And with luck, we're going to make this country and its rules and laws more responsive to everyday people. You can see that building. One of the reasons I highlighted the Mamdani speech yesterday, a lot of people said, oh, we don't know what he's going to do. And I'm like, 100%, we don't know what he's going to do. And I'm always a skeptic when a politician says they're going to do anything. But the language matters. The fact that, you know, he's talking about using a government for good anymore, stopping corruption and so on. This is the moment for the next, like I say, 3 months is the time I give it. I'm thinking we're going to have an answer by May as to what's going to happen to the Trump regime. But now is not the time to roll your eyes and say, we always go into Latin America. The United States has a terrible history with Latin America, going back to the 1840s, at least. That's a rabbit hole someday that I'll, well, not even a rabbit hole. Someday I'll do a whole episode at least on that. But this is not that usual. This is an attempt to side with Russia to overturn the rules-based international order and align the United States with Russia rather than with Europe, rather than with democracies, rather than with the idea that countries should have their own right to sovereignty. And once we have given that up, we have not only given up the sovereignty of all nations, because all it takes is somebody with more muscle to come take you over, we will also have given up a significant portion of the American Constitution and given the president the ability to take the U.S. military and do whatever he wants with it without oversight by Congress. And so when those strikes, literally last night, I was finishing the letter and I was all set to go to bed. I wanted to go to bed earlier, but I was reading the news. And always when I finish a letter, I always am thinking about the next one. And I was actually sort of shaping out the next two. And I saw the first video coming out of Venezuela. I remember it was 1:38. And I was like, no. And then within 10 minutes, there was confirmation. And I thought, this is it. Here we go. On that note, please speak up. This is it. And it's going to get worse. I've maintained this all along. It's going to get worse. But the vast majority of Americans want the Constitution. They want rules. They want laws that apply equally to everybody. They want to be treated equally before the law. They want to have a right to a say in their government. And they want to have equal access to resources. And my friends, that is not a radical position. That is the same position that FDR had in the 1930s. It is the same position that Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, had at the turn of the last century. It is the same position that Abraham Lincoln took in the 1860s. That's what it means to be an American. And this is our moment to try and protect that for the 21st century.
Yeah, this is the moment. So that was the voice of Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor at Boston College. She's the author of the best-selling book, Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America. And it's pretty grim, you know. And as a woman, a Puerto Rican, who's been very much aware of the U.S. and its colonization, Puerto Rico is one of the oldest colonies of the U.S., it really lays out. I love the way she laid out all the ramifications of what looks like, oh, we're just coming in and sort of taking out this leader of this small Latin American country. But there is so much more to that. The importance of the United Nations being sidelined, the collapse of the rules-based international order, the amount of men who have been killed in Russia while they pursue their aggression. And any woman who has children, I mean, I have two young men, I did not raise them to be soldiers, and this is the road we're on. So the U.S. is on a path to become a one-party dictatorial state. I mean, you heard her talk about how the administration informed Republicans about the action, but not Democrats. A lot of disturbing things that happened over this weekend over the U.S. actions. My name is Vilma V. Thank you so much for being part of this. Go out and make your voice be heard. Thank you.
What's going on, Los Angeles? My name is Kat Brooks. I'm a boots-on-the-ground organizer, artist, abolitionist, and the host of Law & Disorder. Born at KPFA in the Bay 3 years ago, L&D seeks to be a partner in movement by making space and place for the freedom fighters locked out of mainstream media, artists using their work as active resistance, and connecting with our brothers and sisters on the other side of the walls. You can tune in for that fire Monday through Thursdays at 8 a.m. on 90.7 FM or online at kpfk.org.
You know that cabin you don't use anymore? If the upkeep just doesn't seem worth it, consider donating it to KPFK. We'll assign a real estate expert to manage the process and help maximize the value. And since we're a nonprofit, your donation is tax deductible. The process is easy, and the impact on KPFK's future can be lasting. If you have land or real estate you no longer need, it could become a powerful way to support the programs you care about. Learn more today at kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's going to try to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight do not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history. We have to.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Audie. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant. We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
Many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men. But the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths. As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well. Activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble...
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
A number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And one day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the women's liberation movement, I had two little kids under 5. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, there's a whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way, but there's a whole lot.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it. You could feel it. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had 3 abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortion. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Our bodies, our lives, our right to decide.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at a event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs, and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists, and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor. Asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes. And a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time. And so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis where the procedures would be done.
The service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care, and then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment. But we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids in daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for child care. It's in NOW's statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We proclaim that when we talk about 24-hour child care, we mean to have it.
After a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
Be crazy.
You've got
to tell me you have to have a medical reason. You have to be sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this. The Young Arts Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women, down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your... And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the Student Health Service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. And it was only with the feminist women that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People who are not used to thinking of rape as the political crime against women. That was our slogan, rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006, my mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started the women's liberation movement. And I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there. They're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing.
What are you doing? You're under attack!
Stand up, fight back!
What are you doing? You're under attack!
Stand up, fight back!
The problem is rapists, and we need to address the problem. And let me give you a hint, it's not our clothes. It's not.
There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped. Well, she was asking for it. She was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
NYPD rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any childcare.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
This fight is not over. This fight is not over.
Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr.
Wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.